and call our last case of today, number 17-1491, Lazar v. Superintendent Fayette SCI, Mr. Epstein and Mr. Goldsboro. Take your time, you're fine.
Proceed. May it please the court, my name is Jules Epstein. I apologize for the frog in my throat, it's this seasonal affect. I represent Stephen Lazar. With your permission, I have requested to reserve 2 minutes.
That's fine.
Thank you. If the court please, this is a case where several facts are beyond dispute. Fact one, Mr. Lazar was a methadone user at a very high dosage. Fact two, his last methadone dispersal or getting treatment of methadone occurred approximately 22 hours before his arrest, which meant that his interrogation, which had statements at the 33-hour and the 50-hour point subsequent to his receiving his last dose, would be at a point where normally the body is going through withdrawal. Fact three, withdrawal can be quite painful.
But you can also make truthful statements during withdrawal, and I understand an expert testified to that.
I'm not disputing that. If I may, Judge Fuentes, one can, but a jury to decide whether it's truthful is entitled to the information of what condition one was in. And that goes to fact four, again, beyond cavil. And that is that it was because of trial counsel's error that the jury was misinformed and told his last dose was a month before. I'm going to suggest to you that there is a fact five that is beyond dispute, and that makes clear his entitlement to relief. The two police statements that are at the core of this case are the core, if not sole proof, of robbery. In other words, there are statements that he's alleged to have made to a series of his drug-using friends that I killed somebody. A jury acquitted him of intentional murder. To convict him of felony murder, there had to be an actus, either as a direct participant or an accomplice, and a felony. The proof of the felony comes from the police statements. We are here to ask this court to determine the following.
Well, may I ask you, he had actually made statements not just to the police, but he had made statements to other individuals. Five people, if I remember correctly, testified to statements that Lazar made implicating himself at the scene of the homicide.
Yes, but not as to the felony component, Your Honor. To be convicted of felony murder in Pennsylvania, there must be proof of a felony. It's during the commission of, and we have designated felonies under the Pennsylvania statute. The one here would be robbery. Absent the police statements, his statements to his friends, and I can talk later about why they're not overwhelming evidence, were, I killed a guy, I used a hatchet, things to that effect. Sans mention of a felony.
When you put everything together, the five statements, and then his own statement, although I understand he had taken methadone about 24 hours, before he made the statement.
Respectfully.
You put all that together, why couldn't the jury come to the... I mean, you're asking us to tell the jury you got it all wrong. You found facts, but they don't make sense.
Just the opposite, respectfully. First, a factual correction, if I may, Judge Fuentes.
Sure.
The 24 hours is the gap between his last methadone and his arrest. 10:30 on the 18th, the morning of the 18th, he gets methadone. You get methadone on a daily basis because after 24 hours, withdrawal starts to kick in. His first statement is 7:30 the next night. So now we're well into the 30-plus hours range. His final statement, which is what the Commonwealth principally relies on to convict, is at the 50-hour stage. But we're not asking the court to say to the jury, you got it wrong. We're asking the court to say that Mr. Lazar was entitled to have a jury weigh whether the fact that he was no longer getting this necessary medication raised an issue of the reliability of that statement.
What do you make of the district court standard of review, Mr. Epstein?
I'm sorry?
The district court standard of review here, did the district court get it right?
I respectfully say no. I realize the Commonwealth says the district court got it wrong in the sense that they don't think there should have been a COA. Our position is that the district court got it wrong, that there were grounds for de novo review. And there are two such grounds. Ground one...
Well, that's... I had the same thought as just Restrepo, but if that's true, what's the remedy? If he got it wrong because he got the standard of review wrong...
Then this court would say, Judge Fuentes, that indeed...
Maybe he shouldn't have granted the certificate of appealability.
No, I'm suggesting that the way he got it wrong is a way that this court can remedy because he got it wrong, in fact, that Mr. Lazar was entitled to de novo review. I need to back up for one second.
That's not a basis for issuing a certificate of appealability.
Well, I may have misheard Judge Restrepo's question because I think there are actually two questions here. So one is, the Commonwealth argues that Judge McHugh got this wrong and we shouldn't even be here.
Well, regardless of that position,
right.
What standard review should the district court have taken to the merits?
My argument is, and the law is, that Mr. Lazar was entitled to de novo review for two discrete reasons. And in other words, not at pedeference. Reason number one, the state courts, when it weighed prejudice, remember the state courts found deficient performance.
No
prejudice, overwhelming evidence. When you read the trial judge, who was also the PCRA judge, Judge DeFino Nastasi's opinion, and when you read the Superior Court opinion, they simply treat as unimpeached the five lay witnesses, and they ignore the fact that none of those witnesses' statements make out robbery. There are also other aspects of the defense case that they ignored. Like it or not, when weighing prejudice, you have to take the good and the bad, and they only took the bad. The separate reason is, in the state courts, we argued from day one that the methadone information was pertinent to two discrete claims. One, the jury determination of voluntariness, but two, and this goes back to Judge Fuentes' comment at the beginning.
Let me just ask a question.
Reliability. I'm sorry, Judge Amber.
That's okay. Why is there substantial evidence that methadone withdrawal, could have changed the outcome of the trial here? Given the experts said that he was taking other medications that could suppress the delay symptoms of withdrawal.
Because the expert nonetheless opined, and we quote this in our brief, that he would have been in withdrawal and it would have impaired his volition and his ability to make rational decisions.
Well, but the hospital records show that the medications that he was being given were a low dose of withdrawal medication.
I understand that, but what we're getting to now is, Judge Amber, we had competing experts. I can only say the expert we retained, Dr. Woody, is a world-renowned expert on methadone and its withdrawal, and the impact of withdrawal, I should say. And he opined that this would have affected, or certainly could have. The point is that there
affected,
affected what?
Yeah.
Affected the ability to make a rational decision, affected the ability to withstand the pressures of interrogation.
So does that go to the reliability of the confession?
Affected the ability to give a reliable statement. And again, this comes back to that it's the police-obtained statement or statements that establish the felony component here.
You think the statements that he made to the other individuals who testified in the case amount to nothing?
No, sir, I did not say that, nor would I.
Let's say have no bearing on whether he, in fact, committed the homicide or not?
I don't say they have no bearing. Neither of those questions, respectfully, is the apt question when you're looking at prejudice. Yes, there are statements. On the other hand, they are statements that don't address that felony component. So assume they make him guilty of some involvement. He was convicted of felony murder. They don't do the job.
You don't think a jury could, based on instructions of the court and based on the arguments presented by counsel, could make rational inferences from the evidence that is presented to them?
Respectfully, the Commonwealth, in its closing argument, used explicitly the statement to the police to say, and that's what made this felony murder. The statements to the other people don't.
Did I put all its eggs in that one basket?
On the felony component, yes. Again, Judge Fuentes, if one goes to the closing argument of the Commonwealth, out of approximately 36 pages, 11 are devoted exclusively to the police statement. And it's while discussing that, and I can pull the page if the court needs it, that the Commonwealth says, and listen to that statement, that's what gets you felony murder. The Commonwealth was going for more, but they did that. And the Commonwealth also acknowledged that these statements to the friends were statements made when people are getting high together. But again, I'm trying to distinguish because, yes.
I think it was the government expert and the defense expert both said that a person under methadone can still make truthful statements.
Can, but not necessarily does. And
that's an argument. Isn't that an argument for counsel to make?
Counsel was prohibited from making that because counsel never got the right methadone records.
We had, but didn't know.
Yes.
Well, I should correct that. The counsel had a stack of about 500 pages. Within, he had a medication dispersal chart, which ended in October. In that bigger stack were papers showing that it continued beyond. It took me 5 minutes walking to the methadone center to get the complete records.
Look, Judge McKee was clearly troubled by this confession.
Right.
But isn't he bound, aren't we all bound by this, the Colorado versus Connolly, the Supreme Court case, with respect to...
I'm sorry. I apologize.
The unreliability is not a basis to suppress the statement.
I'm not asking for suppression. Please hear, I am not challenging the trial court's decision to not suppress the statement. This goes solely to a jury, and it's included in the jury instructions in this case, was told to decide two things. Was this confession voluntary? If not, disregard it. If it was voluntary, make a separate determination. Was it reliable? Not was it reliable for suppression issue, but as a fact finding, was it reliable? Can you take it to the bank?
And because the jury... Go ahead.
Didn't they make that decision?
They made that decision without the information that he had been on methadone up till 24 hours before and without the benefit of an expert. Trial counsel had hired an expert, but the expert said, with the records you gave me, because trial counsel only looked at that top layer, couldn't go forward. So it's not that the jury didn't get a chance legally. It's a jury didn't get a chance because they were never given the data.
But then Judge DeFino, in essence, made the same analysis and came to the conclusion there was ineffectiveness but no prejudice.
She did, and we suggest that that's wrong because she did not weigh the impeachment material, the fact of an alternative suspect, and most critically, that this statement went to the robbery. I see that my time is up. Thank you very much.
We'll be back on rebuttal. Mr. Goldsboro.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm John Goldsboro from the Philadelphia DA's office representing the appellees. Your Honors, initially I'd just like to thank the Court for rescheduling the oral argument here to allow us an opportunity to reevaluate, and I'd like to thank esteemed opposing counsel for not opposing that request. Your Honors, I'd like to make it clear that through no fault of the Commonwealth, it was wrong and a mistake that both sides stipulated a trial that the last dose of methadone was in October in this case. But The district court was right and did act reasonably after a full hearing.
The district court or the trial court?
I apologize. The PCRA court was right after a full hearing, and the district court was right to find reasonable what the PCRA court found, which is that there was no prejudice applying the inherently hypothetical Strickland standard. And I'd just like to read a little bit from the PCRA court's finding on that. It's from the notes and testimony of July 15th, 2013, at page 15, stating not only that this court does not find that there would be a reasonable probability that the outcome of the trial would have been different had the jury received this information, at best they would have heard from competing experts, in other words, taking the bad with the good, that the defendant was experiencing an unknown quantum of withdrawal symptoms during the taking of his statements. This evidence, the court finds, would have little weight up against the hospital records, as Judge Ambrose, you've referred to, which provided direct observations by trained medical experts, and I might add that was 5 hours after the last, 5 to 6 hours after the last statement was signed. Even if one could find that the jury could have found the statements to be involuntary, based on the additional information which would have been presented had counsel not performed unreasonably, there is still, in this case, overwhelming evidence of guilt, as provided by the defendant himself in making statements regarding his involvement in the murders to numerous witnesses who testified at the trial. So I think the court, as the Superior Court found, did look at all of the other evidence, the totality, and didn't need to enumerate every single thing it was considering when it was considering the hypothetical analysis in Strickland, whether there would be a reasonable probability that the result would have differed had this evidence been presented. But it's not just the evidence.
Is it the case that that last statement to the police is probably the most important in this case as far as the prosecution is concerned? That's the one where he apparently made clear that there was direct complicity in the murder?
Yes, that he participated in it by striking the victim as well as by getting the proceeds of the robbery. And that's the only one where he directly admits that, but there is other evidence of robbery.
But what if he didn't have that?
Supposing that
were taken out, you wouldn't have felony murder, would you?
Well, I think we would still, because and I think the trial court, as I said in that, would still has already said that it wouldn't have changed the result, and that is because if that statement had been found involuntary and would have been out of the case, you still have the statement of the 19th, where he agrees to participate in robbery with this friend, imaginary or not, John from Puerto Rico, who has never been found. But he agrees to that, and then he goes, John takes his suitcase, and he admits in that statement of the 19th that his suitcase was left in the property during this murder, and that he came upon John later, and he saw the body on the floor, he saw the bloody scene, he saw John rifling through the drawers looking for silver, looking for things to take. And then when he's asked, well, did you get any of the proceeds of the robbery, he denies it. He said, no, I ran away immediately. But I think circumstantial evidence shows the victim's wallet was missing, the victim's keys were missing, the drawers had been rifled through, there was a gold chain on the floor. The victim's daughter testified that his keys and wallet were not there. So I think you have circumstantial evidence of a robbery, and I think you have a defendant agreeing to participate in a robbery with this other fellow. So I think that's the basis of the PCRA court's finding. And again, she was the trial court judge. Judge DeFino Nastasi saw all of the testimony during trial, motion to suppress trial, and PCRA. And I think this was the basis for her finding that even had the jury found that last statement to have been involuntary, there would still not have been an effect on the verdict.
He had made prior statements to several people that testified, I understand, but he never said he killed anybody, did he?
Oh, in the other statements to his friends, he did.
Yeah.
He did. To not only the five who testified, but to three others.
So if you took out the statement to the police, then you still have enough statements to other individuals that he was not only there, but participated in a homicide?
That's correct. And they interlock. And the way it came to light was not the police focusing immediately on Mr. Lazar. His roommate and he had what the police termed a domestic dispute. And they came to find he and his roommate fighting, and since Lazar was on the lease, they took Russell Angeli and said, well, you have to leave now. You can't stay here, so let's take you to somewhere else. Apparently they were going to book him for fighting for assault, and he said, I have some information that's been on my mind that's been bothering me because Mr. Lazar has confessed to me this murder and shown me this suitcase and told me that he really did do it. And then several days later, I believe that was on November 2nd, then Sarn Wilson, another methadone clinic friend of both Lazar and Angeli, came forward to the police on his own. He was a friend of Angeli, and apparently Angeli had said something to him about going to police because he was concerned. Wilson said to the police, I've been telling Russell Angeli to leave that situation where he's sharing a room with Lazar because Lazar's getting worse. He has knives all the time, and he's confessed to both of us that he committed murder. Angeli said that Lazar told him about it in July, right after Lazar returned from the police, and then a month later in August. And Sarn Wilson said that Lazar told him about it in October. These are witnesses coming forward.
None of those statements implicated felony murder, correct?
That's correct.
And this is Mr. Epstein's point.
Yes.
The only statement that implicated felony murder was the one at issue.
The very last one talks about, it admits robbery. That's the November 20th one. But the November 19th one, which is far less likely to have been affected by any of the slowly progressing methadone symptoms, according to both experts, that one admits that he agreed to commit robbery and then came upon his friend with, you know, whom he agreed to do it, and a dead body at his feet and blood all over the place and looking for valuables. So it's close. It's close. It's I think, enough, as the trial court found, as the PCRA court found.
What do you think of his comment on the statement of standard of review, that viewing this as de novo review?
Yes, I don't understand that, because there was a full PCRA evidentiary hearing on this one claim. There was one claim in his habeas petition. It's the ineffectiveness of counsel for failing to get these methadone to get and present these records, and that's the claim that the PCRA court held a hearing on, and I don't understand how AEDPA review could not possibly apply to that when the state court not only, you know, held a hearing, it adjudicated on the merits, it denied it after a very, very careful searching inquiry. I mean, the PCRA judge was asking questions from the bench here of both experts and of the police officers who testified. And by the way, as long as we're talking about the experts, the progression of symptoms, I think, is particularly important here, because both experts talked about, you pointed out, Judge Fuentes, the fact that he was taking other medications at the time, both by self-report and by what was in his urine. And the jury, by the way, heard in stipulation what was in his urine in those hospital records from 5 or 6 hours after the last statement, that those medications not only lessen the severity of withdrawal symptoms, but they slow down the progression. And the progression starts with simply subjective, they both agreed on this, simply subjective things, just like feeling like you have a cold, aches and pains. And then they start to become objective, but the objective symptoms, when they start in this progression, are ambiguous. They start with things like sniffling. And so the police might have thought, well, he has a cold. And then runny eyes, just tearing a little bit more than usual. Then aches and pains, you know, become more severe, and then there becomes nausea. And he did complain of nausea 6 hours after the last statement was signed when he was at the hospital, but they only gave him, according to the hospital records and the expert testimony at the PCR hearing, a little bit of Compazine, one small dose, and normally it would be 3 to 4 per day. They didn't give him any to take with him, and they gave him such a small dose of Clonidine, which is the same as Cataprase, that according to the experts, that dose would not be used for withdrawal symptoms. That is a dose to be used for high blood pressure, and that's exactly what they diagnosed him with. At the hospital, he was not diagnosed with withdrawal symptoms. He was diagnosed with depression, suicidality, I'm in trouble with the police, drugs have ruined my life, he told the hospital workers, and hypertension. And they gave him a little bit of a high blood pressure medication and a little bit of nausea medication and let him go within 20 minutes. And that is not the sort of treatment that they would have given somebody showing extreme withdrawal, according to the experts credited by the PCRA judge.
What standard should a district court have used or used in deciding whether to grant a certificate of appealability?
Your Honor, I don't think that's necessarily our strongest point in the brief, and I would just like to make clear that that we're no longer pursuing the objection to the certificate of appealability. Thank you.
My question.
Yeah. If the court has no further questions.
No, nothing further. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Epstein.
Thank you. 5 points, please. We agree this was no fault of the Commonwealth. This was entirely the fault of deficient counsel, not getting the records and not knowing what to do. Second point, my colleague keeps talking about involuntary. We are focused on reliability. The United States Supreme Court has made that distinction clear since 1964. Judge McHugh discusses that in his opinion. Third, respectfully, if one reads the 19th statement, which is at that 7:30 in the evening, 30-some hours, 2 points, withdrawal is already going on. It may not be visible to those watching. That's what they meant by objective. But it is already going on, and it dances around the issue of robbery. Staying with that, Judge Fuentes, you asked about the expert and what he said. Respectfully, the answer is at Supplemental Appendix page 95, when the defense expert, Dr. Woody, said at the PCRA hearing, sometimes people will say, I will do anything to get out of this situation. If this would get me out of it, I will get out of it. They can feel pretty desperate when they're having withdrawal. That is what I meant. That was the expert explaining why he, as a world-regarded expert in this field, said, in his opinion, this statement was neither voluntary nor reliable. Last issue about AEDPA. This is not what claim we raised. Yes, we raised an ineffectiveness claim. But within that the ineffectiveness error was in the state court not looking at the whole record when it decides prejudice. It only looked at the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth. And that entitles this court to do de novo review because that's either contrary to or unreasonable. May I finish my sentence,
sure,
please?
Sure.
And thank you.
No problem.
And the second one, again, is within that rubric, when we argued ineffectiveness in the state court, we said the jury was entitled to hear this evidence not just on voluntariness but on reliability. But both Judge DeFino Nastasi and the Superior Court only addressed voluntariness. So that claim has been raised all along. When it's never addressed by the state court, this court or the district court is entitled to and must review it de novo. I know it's the end of the day.
No problem. Thank you
for your courtesies.
No problem. Very well argued case by both counsel, and we'll take the matter under advisement. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.